Welcome to We've Got Issues. I'm Joshua Holland. This week, we're going to do something a little different, holiday week, but not really different. We're going to talk about moral panics with author Bryn Tannehill, and I'll tell you why I think that it's a timely topic of discussion when we get going. But first, a semi-correction from last week. Not really a correction, but I said last week that it was likely, that I found it likely that Representative-elect George Santos, who has, as you know, no doubt, no, lied about pretty much his entire biography, probably isn't gay. And I said this based on the fact that he has told so many lies with this consistent theme, which is that he is a conservative member of various marginalized groups, right? Which is a classic move among right-wingers. They get to say they left the Democratic plantation or whatever. And he claimed to be Jewish, claimed that his family survived the Holocaust. In another instance that emerged since last week's show, he claimed to be half African-American. And all of those claims were bullshit. And he concealed a divorce from a woman just days before he declared his candidacy. So I figured, okay, it was consistent with this whole theme. But then some reporter found an ex-boyfriend. So it looks like the one thing that he was not lying about was that he is, in fact, bisexual or gay. Whatever. It's a detail that pales next to the question of where this guy's sudden wealth came from, right? If you'll recall, he didn't have any income. He kept getting evicted for non-payment of rent. He ran first in 2020 and he declared that he had no money. And then all of a sudden he's very rich. He tried to explain the sources of his sudden wealth and it was unconvincing. Said he'd made a fortune brokering the sales of like high-end playthings like boats and planes and whatever for rich people. This is all supposedly in the last 2 years. And I think it's safe to say that that seems unlikely. And if a high school, if a guy who did not go to high school graduate, I assume, did end up in such a position, he had to get there through fraud, right? Through misrepresentation. And as I mentioned last week, the alternative is that he's being bankrolled by some, who knows, shadowy rich people. And we do know that a Russian oligarch funneled $56,000 into his campaign accounts after he had been handily defeated in 2020 in that same district, right? So he got all this money, he wasn't expected to win. Anyway, this remains one of the weirdest political stories I can recall, maybe the weirdest. And thankfully, both state and federal investigators are looking at the situation. In other news, The Hill reports that, and I quote, Republicans are recalibrating their messaging on abortion after Democrats successfully used the issue to galvanize their base and win over swing voters in 2022. Big news. But if you read the piece, which I don't recommend because The Hill is trash, it's basically built on some GOP polling memo that nobody reads. No politician is actually going to give a shit about what this memo says. And this story is a remarkable example of normalcy bias, because a normal political party would, in fact, recalibrate its messaging on abortion after, or its position on abortion, maybe, after getting beaten in an election that they were supposed to win and in which their opponents made it a central issue in their campaign. And the Beltway media is desperate to portray the GOP as a normal conservative or center-right political party from a developed country. This is normalcy bias. Now, The Intercept's Mary Tuma has a report about what's really happening in the anti-choice movement. She writes about Texas, and the Texas legislature, I don't think that their session has started. It's not a full year legislature. But, and here I quote, early plans discussed among Republicans include efforts to expand the power of local district attorneys to prosecute abortion providers in counties across the state. And just to translate that, that means that there are district attorneys in like, you know, liberal places in Austin or whatever that won't necessarily charge doctors, try to, you know, prison doctors for providing health services. And this will allow like right wing, far out rural prosecutors to step in. So continuing the quote, to penalize online groups that help Texans receive abortion medication, criminally punish companies that financially support out-of-state abortion travel. Think about that. Criminally punish companies that financially support out-of-state abortion travel. And other measures that would prevent patients from crossing state lines for care. And often, so she continues, often at the forefront of modeling extreme anti-abortion measures, Texas may offer a glimpse of what other states can expect, which means that Texas definitely offers a glimpse of what other states can expect. In other news, in other news, Hannah Allam reports for the Washington Post that efforts to combat political violence are running into a roadblock that we've seen before. We've seen this over and over again. At issue is Republicans blocking efforts to study and combat domestic terrorism. Allam writes, and I quote, Republicans generally have opposed government-funded attempts to study domestic terrorism, joined by influential right-wing outlets in portraying the issue as thought police, as a thought police exercise designed to vilify conservatives and ultimately disarm gun-owning Americans. They're batshit crazy. This is a very bloodless way of saying that they're batshit crazy and they're sympathetic to these terrorists. She continues, GOP officials also claim of a double standard, arguing that mainstream news outlets and Democratic leaders disproportionately focus on the right-wing threat and give a pass to Antifa rioters and left-wing extremists. Antifa rioters is a complete red herring, and the right has had a near monopoly on serious political violence. And I'm not talking about someone throwing punches, but using guns and bombs to try to maim and kill people since the end of the Vietnam War era. And it's interesting because this story actually gives Republicans have one example, right? There was that guy who was a lefty and he shot up the congressional baseball game, hit Steve Scalise. And that was literally 6 years ago. And that's what they keep talking about. And how many mass shootings have we had in this year inspired by right-wing rhetoric? And also, most of the violence that surrounded the Black Lives Matter protests was, in fact, perpetrated by opponents of the protests, including the police. So, and the protesters were the victims of most of the violence. But this is nothing new. Department of Homeland Security, they've been identifying white supremacist and other stripes of far-right terrorism as our top threat for a number of years. And the GOP won't let them do anything about it. And they always use the same story, oh, you're targeting conservatives. And to make matters even worse, a lot of people in those agencies are sympathetic with that same view, which doesn't, you know, doesn't make it easier. And I just want to note that this is all a confession, right? They equate violent extremists with conservatives. They say this, you know, you say, oh, what about this crazy right-wing extremism? And they go, that's conservatism. That's us. That they're telling on themselves. Finally, we hear a lot about the so-called border crisis, right? It describes a flood of refugees seeking asylum on our southern border. It has been going on for a long time. Bipartisan efforts to address the root problems, broken immigration system, blah, blah, blah. That always gets derailed, always by the right. But, and it's impossible to overstate how many lies are packed into the conservative story about what's happening at the border. But one thing you may not have heard is that, and I mean, you may have heard it, it was reported in the New York Times, is that a large and growing portion of those asylum seekers are arriving at our southern border from Cuba. Unlike the boat lifts of earlier generations, Cubans are fleeing and coming to the U.S. overland. So I mentioned that the New York Times reported on this earlier this month. I have a quote from that. The Times reports that Cuba has been hit by a 1-2 punch of tighter U.S. sanctions and the COVID-19 pandemic, which eviscerated one of Cuba's lifelines, the tourism industry. The piece goes on to talk about how there's food shortages, there's no pharmacies are out of drugs, there's all these blackouts, it's a disaster. Again, I quote, over the last year, nearly 250,000 Cubans, more than 2% of the island's 11 million population, have migrated to the United States. Even for a nation known for mass exodus, the current wave is remarkable, larger than the 1980 Mariel boat lift and the 1994 Cuban rafter crisis combined. So this is in part a result of Trump's ham-fisted governance. You'll recall that Obama started the process of normalizing relations with Cuba, and then Trump came in and slapped a bunch of new sanctions on. And I also want to note that Cuban refugees are historically a group that leans heavily toward the Republican Party. So that party has embraced the white supremacist conspiracy theory, the so-called replacement theory, that Democrats are bringing in hordes of illegal immigrants to replace good conservative, like crackers in the heartland, and cement permanent rule and drive us towards fascism or socialism, whatever they talk about. But in reality, it is not illegal to present yourself at the border and request asylum. And if the right could give their nonsense a break, maybe they could try to appeal to some of these newcomers who do get in and become naturalized because they're actually a rich GOP, you know, a fertile field for the GOP to try to find new voters. And with that, let's take a quick break and then we'll jump into this week's show. Stay tuned. Welcome back. Folks, I won't lie, I miss Twitter. And while I am liking many things about Mastodon, it is still a pretty small community. And one of the things that I loved about Twitter is that sometimes you would just run into a random but fascinating thread by some smart person. And my next guest authored one such thread a few weeks ago is about moral panics. And I've been thinking about it a lot. I think it's a timely topic as we prepare for Republicans to take the House, because we're going to see a major party that is consumed with multiple moral panics running a chamber of Congress. And these are, in many instances, moral panics that they engineered and created. Anyway, I am joined now by Bryn Tannehill. Bryn is a former naval aviator and the author of several books. Most recently, The most recent book is titled American Fascism, How the GOP is Subverting Democracy. And you can follow Bryn's work at BrynTannehill.com, all one word. Bryn, welcome to We've Got Issues.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
I'm really happy that you could take the time. Let's talk a little bit about moral panics. They are obviously nothing new. The Salem witch trials went down in the late 1600s. Before we dig into the topic, can you define the term? What makes a moral panic?
A moral panic is essentially something where people are afraid of a threat that is not real, but it seems real enough to them that they take drastic action to an overreaction to counter this perceived threat.
So a great example, and I read this recently, at one point there were more bills in red state legislatures barring or regulating girls' sports, transgender girls in girls' sports, than there were actual transgender girls playing in girls' sports nationwide. So,
pretty much. The example that they found in Utah when they overrode the governor's veto was that the bill was regulating one 13-year-old in the state.
Right. Right.
In Ohio, over the past 7 years, I think they found like six kids. Right.
Right. Right.
It's not a significant issue, and nobody's heard of these kids. But it's a major legislative agenda for the GOP.
You talked in that Twitter thread about Stanley Cohen's book on moral panics, and he identified three characteristics that are typical of these things. Can you tell us a little bit about those three characteristics that are common to various moral panics?
So Stanley Cohen wrote a book all the way back in 1972 about folk devils and moral panics, right? And that's actually the title. And all the way back then, he identified three basic characteristics of a moral panic. First is the media singles out a group of people or groups of people and makes them devils, something that everyone should hate and be afraid of. The second is that the actual threat of this group of people is somewhere between little and none. And the third part is that the concern about the group explodes seemingly overnight and becomes a national issue for no good reason whatsoever.
He wrote, Cohen in his book, he wrote, calling something a moral panic does not imply that this something does not exist or happened at all. And that reaction is based on fantasy, hysteria, delusion, and illusion, or being duped by the powerful. So does that imply that there is usually some sort of kernel of truth?
There is. There are trans people. There are trans people who play sports and use bathrooms. There are some people out there who practice witchcraft and some people who practice Satanism. These things are real, but they're also very, very rare and have zero impact on people's lives.
Would you say that the common belief on the right that critical race theory is poisoning young white school children, is that a moral panic? Because there is no grain of truth really in that. It's a graduate level study that has nothing to do with K-12 education.
So the kernels of truth in it are that critical race theory does exist, that it is taught at graduate levels, and that when you teach real American history, you have to acknowledge that slavery centered around Black people, it centered around the South, and that horrible, horrible things happened, and that there was also systemic segregation, subjugation, yeah, oppression of Black people, and that Black people were not protected fully legally until sometime around the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Voting Rights Act, right? These are things that continue to be real, and they're part of our history, but talking about them in any way other than these things happened in the past and they're not a problem anymore. Everything is perfect and wonderful, and there's no racism, and Racism has no effect on anyone anymore, ever, except in isolated bad apple cases. Right. And that's the only proper way to teach history. So that the moral panic centered on critical race theory is centered on a graduate level course that exists. And it's centered on some teaching that still happens that acknowledges that America isn't perfect with race issues now.
Right.
But everything else beyond that, claiming that it teaches white kids to hate themselves and hate their race and, you know, everything else beyond that is the moral panic part of it.
Okay. And I guess there is another kernel of truth, which is that learning about our history in an unvarnished, accurate way does make you uncomfortable. It's an uncomfortable topic. I mean, it's not a pretty history.
Exactly.
Getting back to Cohen's book and your thread. So you have this rapid emergence of these, what he calls the folk devils, the subject of the panic. And then there is a symbiotic relationship with law enforcement and politicians and the press and those folk devils. Can you unpack that for us a little bit?
So first you have the folk devils, right? And the folk devils can be, you know, some concept like CRT, or it can be in modern times, witches, or now it's trans people, right? The other piece of it is law enforcement, the people who are expected to crack down on the folk devils and do something about it, right? In a legal sense. The other actor you have within this, another actor you have within this is the media, who need to create coverage and label these folk devils in a way that's greatly exaggerated and distorted, in a way that makes everybody afraid and start demanding action to be taken against those folk devils. The other piece of it are politicians or leaders who present themselves as protectors of the moral high ground in society. They join the media and law enforcement in, yes, we're going to pass laws and legislation and policy to fight the evil bad guys, right? Whether the evil bad guys or bad things is Dungeons and Dragons or satanic panic or trans people or critical race theory.
It's there's a whole body of work on the media's role in threat perception. And it's well understood that we don't have a good, we are not good at quantifying the degree to which things are threatening to us. And media amplification can make something that is a remote threat first and foremost on people's minds, or at least it can make it more prominent than it should be. And a great example of this is not necessarily in terms of moral panics. This is more broadly true. And the classic example is sharks, right? I mean, you have almost nothing to fear of sharks. You can swim among them. It's fine. But, you know, when somebody is bitten by a shark somewhere in the world, that becomes a worldwide story. So it's, you know, it's not news when somebody gets run over by a car somewhere far away from you, but it is a news when someone gets bitten by a shark.
So I would say that the shark example you give is a demonstration of how people are really, really bad at judging threats and threat levels.
Yes.
And letting their fears run away with them. But there's no moral component to it. Sharks aren't good or bad. They're just animals, right? That
yes.
Sometimes, you know, take a bite out of people. Moral panics combine the poor human ability to judge threat levels with ascribing moral implications to things that probably shouldn't have moral implications put
yes.
to them.
Yeah. And my sense is that we have a political movement on the right that has grown really adept at creating these kinds of panics out of whole cloth, right? You have a right-wing media ecosystem that doesn't have even the same standards, the same kind of journalistic standards as the mainstream press does. And then you have, and I'm sure a lot of listeners are familiar with a guy named Chris Rufo, who's a fellow at the Claremont Institute. And he's bragged on Twitter very openly, repeatedly, about having fabricated the moral panic over critical race theory. You have a small group of people who have similarly stoked a panic over transgendered women threatening cisgender women in bathrooms. Matt Walsh, this little network of transphobic people. Is that something that has been typical of moral panics in the past, this intentional creation as a political tool? Because I feel like some of the more famous moral panics in our recent past, at least, have been more organic. Maybe that's not the right word, but I think you know what I mean.
So I would say that they are ruthlessly exploiting it in a way that wasn't done in the past, that maybe they actually believed it. Whereas Chris Rufo is cynical and Machiavellian, and he knows that none of what he's saying is true. He's acknowledged it in his tweets. It's just him manufacturing outrage to get people going in the direction he wants them to go. Another example of moral panics in the past that brought the left and the right together. Remember the explicit lyrics and the Two Live Crew stuff and, yeah. You know, Baby Got Back and, you know, oh my God, the lyrics are so filthy and dirty and Thug Life and right. You know, and that's why you had, you know, Tipper Gore and Jesse Helms getting together to put explicit lyrics labels on albums in the late 80s and early 90s, right? Because that was somehow corrupting our youth, which looking back at the albums of the time, it seems pretty quaint. You know, you know, it's the same thing with, you know, Elvis Presley, rock and roll, and oh my God, those hip thrusts.
Yeah.
But now I would, those were somewhat organic. Those were somewhat genuine. Those were, you know, those were, oh my gosh, think of the children. Whereas, you know, Rufo knows exactly what he's doing. And the Claremont Institute knows exactly what they're doing in the sense that they're very openly calling for permanent single party rule in order to change the shape of America for generations, according to their Christian values, which their Christian values would dictate that the best thing for society is that there's no LGBT people.
Right.
And that's the real danger, is it's hiding what the long game is, what the long-term big picture goals of Rufo and the Claremont Institute are.
It's interesting that they try to go back to the well with that classic rap moral panic from the 80s and 90s when WAP came out, this song, very explicit lyrics. There was, what's that guy, Ben Shapiro.
Shapiro.
He had multiple shows about it. He was obsessed with that. And they tried to make it a thing, and it really didn't resonate beyond the right-wing bubble. So there has been some changes, I guess, over the years. You talked about some of the other characteristics of moral panics, and among those is that a significant share of the public comes to believe that the targeted group is, in fact, a threat. How big of a share of the population does it have to be? Because there's always going to be some people who don't get caught up in the moral panic, right? Is there a tipping point in terms of public perception?
Well, I mean, to be blunt, Hitler, only 25.8% of the population in Germany voted for Hitler in January 1933. And that was enough to end up in the slaughter of almost of 2/3 of the Jews in Europe. So that's bad, right?
Yeah, that's bad. But I think a much larger share of the German population shared or at least was sympathetic to his anti-Semitic views.
That's the thing, is that you don't need to have a large proportion of the population buying into it. You just need to have the base of the dominant party being behind it, and you need the rest of the population either confused or apathetic enough that they don't do anything to oppose the overreactions being taken by the politicians and law enforcement to these devils, because, well, no one wants to be seen supporting these people that are, you know, now folk devils. It's bad for your voting. It's could draw unwanted attention to yourself in an authoritarian regime. Hardly anyone wants to stick up for LGBT people in Russia today, because it draws the negative attention to you in ways of, oh, so you're fond of these deviants. You like these deviants. You're in favor of this.
Corrupting children. They use the same rhetorical strategy.
And absolutely. Yeah. A lot of conservatives look at Russia as where the U.S. should go, with a single strong leader who sets social policy and domestic policy based off of conservative-ish religious principles.
No.
Although I use that term very, very loosely, given that, you know, Russia's is super anti-gay. It's also super okay with throwing people out of windows to assassinate them.
Yes.
Yeah, if that's a Christian value.
Well, I mean, you know, there's no hate quite like Christian love. Do you think QAnon is a moral panic? And the reason I ask that is it, in some senses, it is a classic moral panic, but its central narrative is not widely embraced. So you have this small group that believes that there are democratic elites that are, you know, extracting chemicals from abused children in pizza parlor basements. But a much larger group believes that child sex trafficking is a very common crime, far more common than it really is. And QAnon has latched on to legitimate anti-trafficking efforts and mainstream anti-trafficking organizations in order to seek new converts and gain legitimacy. So I'm not sure if it's a cult. Is it a moral panic? What's your thoughts on that?
So yes, it is a moral panic in the sense that it draws on narratives that have been highly effective in the past and continue to be highly effective. If you are aware of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, which was an anti-Semitic conspiracy hoax publication that came out in the early 20th century. It accused a secretive Jewish cabal of doing all kinds of horrible things, including, you know, ritual sacrifice of infants and drinking the blood of babies and all that sort of thing, right? And QAnon draws on that same sort of fear of this secretive cabal of people, you know, stealing babies and draining them of adrenochrome. And, you know, it's obviously, you know, and that was the part of the basis for Pizzagate, right? Which morphed into QAnon. And now with trans people, the same narrative emerges, is that one of the conspiracy theories put out there by Jennifer Billick, who's been promoted by Helen Joyce, who was with The Economist, and has also been promoted by Tucker Carlson and others, is that transgenderism, if you could see my air quotes there, is actually a plot by Jews to destroy Western culture and humanity based on a philosophy of transhumanism, right? And that includes stealing and mutilating children to prevent them from procreating, right? And that it's a conspiracy, right? So QAnon isn't the same thing, but they're all kind of united throughout the 20th and 21st century by this mishmash of moral panic and fear of Jews or cabals stealing children and doing horrible things to them. Whether it's Jews or Hillary Clinton or trans people, it all ends up being the same kind of recycled conspiracy theory that creates a moral panic over something that does happen. But very, very rarely. There are child abductions by strangers, but they're very, very rare. The vast majority are by people that the children know or by family members.
Right. This is clearly the most dangerous moral panic that we're dealing with today. The moral panic that holds that LGBTQ people are grooming children for sexual abuse or to lure them into a, quote, alternative lifestyle. This is closely intertwined with the panic over gender affirming healthcare. And this is extremely, again, extremely dangerous. It's been, I think there's a clear connection between it and the Club Q massacre, which happened shortly after a drag event in Colorado. This has also gotten children's hospitals inundated with bomb threats, et cetera, including children's hospitals that don't do gender affirming healthcare, don't offer it. And it has spilled over, and this is something that is really disturbing, to schools and libraries that carry books that even refer to gender or sexuality or race for that matter. So you don't have to be gay or transgender yourself to be one of the folk devils that must be destroyed in this larger campaign. There's a viral video going around of a librarian actually losing it at a town council meeting somewhere. I think maybe it was in, I want to say, New Hampshire, Vermont. She says at one point that she's a good Catholic, just like the people who are constantly threatening and harassing her and driving her out of the business, right? This is a librarian. Is that typical of moral panics, this kind of spillover?
I would say it is, that moral panics, this is kind of an expression of how moral panics turn into policy decisions and mob actions and volatility and hostility, right? You know, one of the things that I point out in my thread is that other scholars pointed out the characteristics of a moral panic is volatility, hostility, measurable concern, consensus, and a disproportionate reaction, right?
Yeah.
And we're seeing all of that. So banning any and all books that are related to LGBT people is one of the kinds of overreactions. You can see it being measurable in terms of public sentiment about trans people getting worse rather than better over the past few years. You can see that every single southern state and most Midwest states are going after trans people. Disproportionate reaction, passing tons and tons of laws that affect, you know, less than 2,000 kids in the United States, right? Or even two or three kids in an entire state, right? These are all part of it. And they're all interconnected, right? And it's, in the big picture, it's Rufo and the Claremont Institute wanting to redefine U.S. society in a way that makes it inhospitable for LGBT people as a whole, that people who are LGBT will choose to stay in the closet forever. Yes. Or right. Leave the states that are targeting them, right?
Yeah.
And they regard a society without LGBT people as a better society. And that's makes me very concerned as someone who understands that the purpose of anti-Semitic laws in Nazi Germany early on was not to kill them. It was simply to make them leave. And indeed, 2/3 of German Jews had left Germany by 1939. Right.
Yeah.
So these are all really dangerous. They're all interconnected and they're all aimed at making people afraid and either stay closeted or leave.
You wrote, and I'm going to quote, you wrote about this in the thread, the worst possible outcome is when an authoritarian government comes to permanent power on the basis of some sort of moral panic. And you add that this is, and again, I quote, when conditions are ripe for genocide. One common refrain we hear is that the far right's growing extremism is a sign of weakness rather than strength. And there is a perhaps overly optimistic theory out there that the American system has some sort of like circuit breaker that keeps us from sliding too far into the extremes, and that we saw that in action during these past midterms. What is your view? Is that
so? I disagree. I think it's a sign of their strength. They are saying the quiet part loud because they know that they can say the quiet part loud and not lose power. Remember, something close to 92 or 95% of U.S. House races are not competitive due to gerrymandering and geographical polarization that the primary system in the United States has forces people to run to the flanks, particularly people in Republican states, conservative states. People don't say, politicians don't say these things unless they're comfortable saying them and they don't think it's going to cost them popularity. They think it's going to help them. And right now, taking more and more extreme positions on LGBT people is something they believe will help them, right? It's also worth pointing out that the Republicans still managed to control the U.S. House of Representatives despite going very extreme and waging culture wars, right? You know, oh, well, we didn't lose as badly as we thought we were going to. Well, you still lost. We still don't control the House of Representatives. The other piece is that, you know, from a electoral map standpoint, the map this year for Democrats was very favorable. In 2024, Democrats are going to be defending three times as many seats as Republicans in the Senate.
Yeah.
If you look at the polling data on Biden versus a hypothetical matchup against DeSantis or Trump, both of whom have pursued extremely anti-LGBT agendas and made culture war a big part of their speeches and policy, it's going to be tough. And because of the way the tilt in the Electoral College is, Republicans have a 4.5-point advantage in the Electoral College, meaning that in order for Democrats to have a 50-50 chance of winning, they need to win the popular vote by about 4.5%. And that's ugly. And yeah. Republicans feel like they are on the offensive for the most part.
Bryn, do we know how to counter a moral panic? Is there a formula? Is there a roadmap?
So I think the biggest pressure point in this is the media. Unfortunately, the media likes moral panics because it gets clicks, it gets eyeballs on paper, it gets eyeballs on screens. And it also works really, really well on social media, right?
Yes.
Look at the number of clicks Chaya Raichik, you know, libs of TikTok generates. And you alluded to it, but what we're seeing is stochastic terrorism. I think that eventually what's going to be a pressure point is that, I hate to say it, we're going to have to wait for an Alex Jones moment when we have a pile of dead people from somebody who was inspired by Raichik or Matt Walsh at a children's hospital, and then you can sue them into the ground. The way Alex Jones got sued into the ground.
I mean, that maybe, we had a big body count in Club Q.
And it's going to have to be something that's undeniably tied to Raichik or Walsh. Or Rufo or one of the others. And that's the problem, is that you notice that we've talked about moral panics dating back to the start of the 20th century and even back to the, you know, the witch hunts of the, you know, the 15th, 16th century, and going back beyond that, you had the moral panics of during the plague, right?
Yeah.
You know, the 14th century, where, you know, oh, the Jews are poisoning the wells. Let's stone them, right? So moral panics are just a part of human psychology. And because there's profit to be made from it, it's really tough to fight the media.
Yeah.
And I think the only way that we have right now effectively of fighting it is using the power of lawsuits, or changing the law to make it easier to file for civil penalties against those who inspire moral panics that result in death, mayhem,
or crimes,
acts of violence, stochastic terrorism.
Yeah. I mean, When you're counting on the legacy media to be the bulwark against this kind of fascist campaign, that's a very, it's not a pleasant place to be.
If you look at the New York Times, the amount of anti-trans content that they've been promoting, the both-sidism, the we're just asking questions kind of journalism.
Yes.
Calling
it a debate.
Calling it a debate, selectively only interviewing people who are from one side and then giving, you know, like half a paragraph to the other side on, you know, in the 13th paragraph, or inserting anti-trans stuff into things that have nothing to do with it. Yesterday they had an article about parties and going to holiday parties, and they stuck some anti-trans stuff in the middle of it, which was totally out of place, but it goes along with promoting the moral panic of trans youth in healthcare.
Yeah. Yeah. Bryn Tannehill, I believe we are out of time, but I really want to thank you for offering us your time, and especially when you are on vacation this holiday week. I really do appreciate it.
Thank you for having me on. It's been my pleasure.
Folks, check out Bryn's writing on the far right and other topics at bryntannehill.com. And again, read Bryn's book. It's called American Fascism, How the GOP is Subverting Democracy. I'd also like to thank David Edwards, our producer and engineer, and I'd like to thank the good folks at Raw Story and Alternet for supporting the show. You can follow me on Mastodon. Follow me on Mastodon. Why not? Find me on Mastodon. You can also subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. I would like to thank all of you fine people for tuning in. Have a terrific New Year's, and we'll catch you in 2023.